Hello. Hello, everyone. We're back. It's been a while. It's me and it's...
Hello.
Detached Scott out in the wilderness.
I am at the Microsoft Portland office.
Oh,
there's a ball here.
What do they call this? Swiss balls. Yoga balls.
It's hard. You can't really see. This is basically the Portland office. They're having a developer fest. You can feel the festive feeling that we have here in this drop-in office with...
You seem festive.
It's so quiet.
You realize it is only like before lunchtime.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
In my world means that nothing is happening.
Mm.
It's just us. We haven't been on together for a while. John is not here. John is traveling, I believe.
I think he's on the way to Belgium.
Belgium. Okay, then. Yeah, obviously we're all coming off the high of Build last week. I believe there's a special show later this week where there's going to be like an Uber Build recap from all the different .NET community stand-up stars, of which I am not one, so I will not be there.
Stars.
But it's you and me right now, so we can recap whatever we want in our world. Obviously, yeah, there was a whole bunch of stuff going on. We announced at Build last week. We were just having a bit of a moan fest here before going live about our regular disdain for the performance of our laptops, which I think is just a genuine, you know, recurring theme on this show.
I just want my laptop to be as fast as possible, as often as possible.
Absolutely.
And the hardest part is I just don't understand how it decides what runs on the discrete graphic card and what runs on the regular graphics card.
And we were comparing. So like my Lenovo X1 Extreme here, which is just running, like plugged into power. I do have HDMI out, but it's not doing anything right now because it's
on. Well,
Is using some discrete GPU. Like 17% of the NVIDIA is being used right now. I don't know what for. I guess I could figure that out, couldn't I?
Well, like I want to say, Teams should use the NVIDIA.
Because you have a hypothesis that would make it faster, right?
Maybe. Well, so the integrated Intel stuff uses part of my shared memory, right? Like, am I wrong? Does it have its own dedicated video memory? I don't think so.
Very little, if any, yeah.
Right.
And you only have 16 gig in yours, whereas I have 32 gig.
And that's the other thing, right? Yeah. Like, I think I have reached the point where 16 gigs in a laptop for what I needed to do is unacceptable.
That's interesting.
So it says here, shared GPU memory, 1 gig of 8. But the NVIDIA on my laptop has 6 gigs of dedicated RAM. Like, my perspective is, if it's plugged in, it there's no reason it should not be using dedicated whatever. So I suspect that there is a misconfiguration. There's no other explanation. I have done something wrong. I think also that I have a feeling like my machine is optimized that I might turn it into a tablet at any moment.
Right.
Because it's a Surface Book, right? So right. I think that they suspect that I'm there with my finger hovering over the eject button. At any second, I might decide to use the pen. And I'd like to, like, have a slider bar of, like, the likelihood of Scott's sense to use the pen. You know what I mean? And I want to put it at the low end of, like, there's no scenario where I'm going to use the pen.
Maybe you have the wrong device. I'll just say it. Maybe for your workload, you don't need a convertible thing. You just need to get a good workstation.
I really like it otherwise.
Maybe you need a good workstation and a cheaper, dedicated portable device.
To be clear, I do have a good workstation.
Okay.
It's lovely. I've got that i9 that I built.
Oh, at home, tethered to your desk, right.
Tethered, yeah.
Yes. I've given up, and everyone knows who's watched this show for any period of time that I'm just perpetually unhappy with my hardware. I have given up yet again.
I thought you were going to stop at perpetually unhappy.
Well, I am a happy person, cheeky sod.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to get a desktop for work. I'm just the docking, redocking lifestyle as someone who's in and out of meetings all day. I'm just sick of waiting for things. And I drive two 4K monitors from this. And it is capable. Don't get me wrong. It's actually quite, you know, it's impressive what modern laptops can do. But they just pale to a desktop that's a third of their price. They just cannot compete when it comes to push the keyboard and it's instantly up and I can start moving windows around and reply in Outlook and I don't have to wait for 15 seconds. Or even worse, The one that's really been bugging me, I don't know if it bugs you, and yeah, we'll talk about .NET in a minute. The one that's really been bugging me is the, I close my laptop at the end of the day, and I stick it in my bag, and then if I'm being a really good person, I don't touch it again until I get to work the next morning, right? Because that's what you should do, as much as I can afford to do that. And then so I do that, and I get to work, and I go to my first meeting, and I open it, and then literally for the first 5 minutes, it's unusable. It's not hyperbole. I'm not saying 5 minutes and I mean 25 seconds. Literally for the first 5 minutes, everything wakes up and says, I have to go and check to see if something happened in the last 14 hours since you used me. And by the way, I'm going to take all your CPU and all your interrupts, and your mouse is going to lag literally while you're trying to move across the screen. And it's not just this laptop. I know other people here who have been suffering.
No, it's everybody. It's the indexer. It's the
OneDrive. It's group policy. It's AV. It's the store. It's Office updates. It's VS updates. It's literally everything.
I get that there's malware in the world.
Yeah.
And I get that everyone thinks that they're invincible and they are like, you can't malware, but really you can't. Like, I'm not going to get malware. I promise. It's not me. And I feel like one processor of my machine is dedicated to running anti-malware. In the off chance that one of the zip files that I downloaded 10 years ago might have malware in it. But I don't see why you need to for each over my zip files looking for malware, because I'm pretty sure it ain't there.
The thing that really irks me is that I remember going to Mix in 2010, I think it was, the last Mix maybe, and I think it was Snosky was on stage and he showed IE9, the native web, right? That was the thing we were doing 10 years ago, the native web, and he showed a video. It was like a FLAC file, like not FLAC audio. It was a video file, AFLV file or something, playing in the, that's a nice ceiling, playing in
my
IE9.
My mustache hairs.
And it was
going
like
into my nose.
It wasn't 4K. It was like 1080p video or something. And everyone was like, oh my Lord, it's in the browser and it's 1080p and the CPU is doing nothing, right? Because it was hardware accelerated. Da, da, da. And then to really drop the mic, he scrolled in the other window because there was two 1080p videos playing in the browser, hardware accelerated. And the laptop just dealt with it, and it was fine. But that was 10 years ago, and today
it's artificial, though. It's artificial because when you go and show a video playing, you're showing one specific kind of thing. You're showing video decoding.
I agree.
Onto a plane.
Yep.
And it makes you feel like it's complicated.
But it was. Because there's a lot. I remember when it was.
I would propose that it makes you feel like it's complicated because there's a lot of stuff going on within the frame, like fish or whatever.
Yeah.
But the reality is there isn't. An actual thing would be the real-time rendering of all of the fish at 1080p.
That was the other demo they did, right? IE9 had the literally the aquarium demo where they drew them in HTML5.
That was mostly just a sprite exercise.
Well, sure, but okay. I'm simply trying to state that there have been real advances made. Like I remember when Intel came out with MMX and like the promise of 20 frame per second postage stamp video online became something that we could all look forward to. And then fast forward, 6 years, literally it was less than a decade and we had multiple 1080p rendering on a laptop on battery power, and it was really good and the CPU wasn't really involved. And then fast forward to today and it feels like, Maybe, you know what this is? Maybe this is the difference between bandwidth and latency. And you know how they say, like, once you get the bandwidth is very different to latency. And you won't, once you get the video going, as long as you've got the bandwidth, it won't skip. Like, it's there, it's going to go, it'll render, it's fine. But latency, you'll notice every single thing that gets called, causes a stutter due to latency. And
well,
that may be what
about,
we're talking about. It's that same analogy.
Yeah, we always joke about how, Outlook, like, and doing anything in Outlook is a blocking call. And the problem is that doing anything in Outlook puts something on the wire, and that's all network latency.
So someone just said, guys, what did I miss? And someone said, old people complaining about hardware. That's the most accurate description of the beginning of our show that I think I've ever seen.
I don't know if it's old people. I hear what you're saying, and that's funny to say. But it's also people who know how the stack works, frustrated with the issues with the stack.
That's true. I will say I have a friend, our good friend Brad Wilson, who former ASP.NET team engineer who now works in App Center at Microsoft. He runs Linux on here. He runs Ubuntu. He's currently on 19.04. I think the latest, what's it called? Disco something.
Which I installed yesterday and I'm having nothing but trouble with.
So he runs it natively on, He runs it natively on his Dell XPS 13 laptop and just loves it. Just like, there's nothing but good things to say about it, performance and all the rest of it. Yeah.
Does he ever like use a video card or audio card?
He has a separate rig for video. I'm pretty sure he does use the audio card.
As a general purpose operating system, I find it frustrating.
Yeah.
Just getting drivers to work. But yes, for doing terminals and browsing, it works great.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. It's like all the people who tell me to use Outlook for web, and then I go and try, and then the first 3 minutes I'm cursing, and I have to go back to Outlook desktop because none of my keyboard shortcuts work, and I can't navigate with the arrow keys, and I can't do all the things that I have to be able to do to effectively manage my email. But
yeah,
I try. I really do try, and people give me these suggestions. I go and try it again.
You and I did the exercise. We sat down with Outlook for web, and as soon as you hit one shortcut, rather than adapting.
Yep. Well, it wasn't. I actually spoke to someone on the team. They pointed out all the shortcuts, and I learned some of the different shortcuts. The problem was the core navigation principle was so fundamentally different. Like they in Outlook for Web, the right-hand pane. So yeah, I use Conversation View, which
the same behaves person, differently. Than
and the right-hand pane behaves very differently. So when I you can't actually use any short key to navigate through individual messages in a thread, and then have the navigation pane, the preview pane, sorry, on the right. Like scroll into or show a preview of what you've currently got hovered. That does not exist in Outlook for Web, as far as I understand. But that is the primary way I look at email in Outlook, because most of the email I look at is heavily threaded, as you well know, working here on the same teams that I do. And so I arrow up and I left and right arrow to collapse. And I do all that stuff all the time, and I'm constantly looking at the right-hand preview pane to read what is in what I've currently got selected. But I just couldn't find a workflow for doing that on the web. So I'm back in the desktop, and as much as it annoys me sometimes, it is much more usable for me. But
I'm full in Outlook for web at this point. I'm loving it.
Interesting. You showed me a bunch of the features, and the features look really nice. Like the integration with Delve and the graph and rather that all that stuff looked really cool. And I really look forward to using it. I kind of just made me bummed that it wasn't there in the desktop version to the same extent. So it's coming. I've seen some of it show up.
One of the things I've been using lately in Outlook for web is this schedule item where it's like basically snoozing an email. So it's like, here's an email here I don't need to see, so I can go and say schedule tomorrow, and now it's out of my inbox.
Interesting.
It's not really, but it'll be back tomorrow. But it's emotionally out of my inbox.
It's emotionally out of my inbox. I like it.
Seriously.
I like it.
Like, here's another one. Scott Guthrie.
Yeah.
Blah, 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 manager training track. Make sure that you do this by May 31st.
Yes, I actually scheduled time to do that.
Okay, so I did that one.
Mm-hmm.
But I have another one that's August 8th, right? So I'm going to go and say, choose a date. And I'll say, all right, I'll do it when I get back from Belgium. Mm-hmm. So save out of my thing.
Interesting.
So it's the psychic weight of the thing hanging out there in my face is gone. And now it'll come back.
Well, shall we talk about some .NET stuff?
We should.
Okay. It's 20 minutes. Nearly 20 minutes.
And let me know if you want me to share my screen, because I got the new terminal installed and I've got .NET. .NET -- version preview 5.0.1.1.5.6.8.
So that's a great place to start. We obviously announced and released .NET Core 3.0 preview 5 last week during build. So the team, it was a small release. It's fair to say that was a release purposely designed to sync with build. And so it was a shorter milestone than we had for the previous previews. We're currently working hard on preview 6, which is a slightly larger milestone. And we hope to land pretty much the rest of the features that we're hoping to see in .NET Core 3. And that's all up and down the stack, right down from the host, you know, the .NET executable itself, all the way up through the CLR, CoreFX, and the various app models. The things that will come a little bit later after preview 6 is some of the tooling things that we want to light up in the new Visual Studio and Visual Studio for Mac. Some of those things are slated to happen after preview 6 as we get closer towards the GA in September, which was the other thing that we announced, which was the schedule for .NET Core 3. So we will have a GA. We tend to call them GAs instead of RTMs now. I've attached myself to GA.
It's stupid. No one else says that. No one else in the industry says any of that stuff.
Okay, well, I'm sorry.
GA, with GA, it's GA. No one knows what that means.
General availability.
I know, but like, we just made it up one day and made it a thing.
Well, all of Azure uses that. You're Mr. Azure Friday. Have you railed against GA on?
Yes, I have.
Oh, what would you prefer we call it?
Released.
Released. Okay, fair enough. Stable.
Alpha, beta, release. That's just my whole thing.
Well, we tried. I was the one who said we're not going to do beta anymore on .NET because no one could agree on what it meant. Every time we called it a beta, we had people complaining that we were calling it a beta. And so I said, fine. I tapped out and just said, let's call them previews. And we'll go from there. So we have, yeah, preview 5, build 011568 is the one we released last week. Wow, you have a lot of them installed.
Well, so my whole thing is I've got my main one, which is 22100.
Okay.
And then everything else is previews that I haven't gotten around
why,
to building.
Why do you... 22100 is your main one?
Well, you know, when I'm not using 3.
Yeah, but like we've done releases since 22100 for 22. 22 was
I
in December.
I just never got around to tidying it up. But I need to go... I wrote that script to go and delete these,
just
but
scroll,
I don't...
Just scroll down to .NET Core runtimes for me. I'm going to shame you. All right, so you don't have any of the patches for 2.2 installed.
Okay, so let's talk about that.
Okay.
So let's go to the .NET. And let's pretend that I don't work here.
Okay.
And let's say, run apps... Mm-hmm. Do this. That's cool. Build apps. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, I can use 2017 or 2019. Cool. Can't find the version you want. Cool. I can hack this URL.
Yep.
So here on the left-hand side, we've got current.
224.
224, right?
Yep.
And so then
and that has a security patch.
So if I want to stay on the hotness, the new one, this would be where I want to be.
That's correct. On the 22 train. Yep.
So then I would go and grab that.
The juju train.
And then go and get that. Now, if I scroll down a little bit, there's a security patch.
Yep. So, yeah. So you can see the reason, and we've explained this before, right? The left-hand side
is the
runtime version, which is the branded, and the SDK, which aligns with multiple things, including VS, but not limited to VS.
Now, if I am risk-averse, I'm going to just keep scrolling until I look for LTS.
That you won't find it here, because 2.2 is not LTS. You'll need to go back to 2.1.
So then I can hack the URL.
That's right. Scroll to the top. Ooh.
I'm going to start this process first.
Okay. Is it loading? There we go. Oh, there we go. 2.1.
There it is. 2.1 LTS. There you go. So that's one. How long will this be supported until?
3 years.
3 years. So 2022.
No, because it went LTS when it went 2.1.3. So if you scroll down, I think it was August last year when it went LTS for the first time. It was then. It was August. Yeah. So I don't know why.
So 2021.
Yeah. So August 2021.
You know what would be nice would be to have it say that.
2021 or 2022? Wasn't it 2021? It was 2018, wasn't it?
Yeah. Okay. But it'd be cool to say, like, if I hovered there.
Yeah. We could talk to Rowan about that.
Tell me how long it would be last.
I mean, obviously, it does say that in other places. It just doesn't say it on this particular download page. It says it on the support lifecycle page.
Now, we talk about these previews and that we should, like, remove them and stuff. And I know I can, like, safely go in here and
delete those. Yeah.
The previews and stuff. But there was a concern a while back on the Twitters that if you removed the wrong thing, it would break Visual Studio. Is that true?
No, because all the installers,
if you remove one of these, Visual Studio requires it or something.
No, because the installers all ref count each other. So I think most developers understand the concept of a ref count, where you have a shared resource, and then the people who are sharing the resource increment, say, yes, I am currently using this, and then something else says, yes, I'm currently using this, so the ref count is now 2. And if someone says, I don't need this anymore, the ref count goes down to 1, and the resource is not released until it hits 0. And so that is true with well-authored installers, if we don't make a mistake, is that you can't break something by uninstalling something if something else needs it. That was a lot of somethings. But you get what I mean. So .NET, Visual Studio will lay down a version of the .NET Core SDK if you choose the .NET Core workload during Visual Studio installation time. And then you can install different versions out of band, or OOB, as we call it, OOB, out of band, to your VS release. And some .NET Core versions are only available as OOB releases. For example, .NET Core 2.2, which we showed here, is not actually installed by VS by default. It is not a default option. When you tick .NET Core, you don't get 2.2. We did not include it in VS 2017 at all. You had to install it as an OOB. In 2019, it is an optional component. So if you wanted to install .NET Core via your Visual Studio installation, with VS 2019, 2.2 is an option. And that's tied back to the whole LTS versus current thing. We didn't want to have a non-LTS release installed by VS 16.0 by default, because 16.0 mm-hmm. itself is LTS. And mm-hmm. that just introduces complications with regards to servicing and whatnot. So here you go. Here is the, is this your blog? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little screenshot. That little screenshot there is from the downloads page. It's the page above the one you were showing before, which shows exactly. all the versions. And that, you know, quite clearly shows which ones are LTS and which ones are current and which ones are still in preview. At the time you wrote that, obviously 2.2 was still in preview.
Right.
And so the problem that we've had with the version proliferation on people's machines is caused by a couple of different things. One, in before 3.0, I'll talk about before 3.0. Then I'll talk about
before
what's
before you yeah. say that, yeah. we're not really using 500 megs.
Yeah, remember yes how we said no. .NET Core is side by side? Do you want to go and see exactly how much it uses? I'll show you how to figure it out.
Well, I would guess I would go down here, and I would go like this. And I would go to SDK, and I would pick one, and I would right-click and say properties. And that one's 200 megs.
So that is just the CLI. Not, that's just the MS build targets and the CLI. It does okay. not include the runtime that came with it. So if you go out okay. to the shared so folder.
Out here.
And go to NetCore app, for example. Yeah, you got a lot of those.
60 megs.
Okay, and then you've also got, which you can't see particularly well here, go back to .NET folder. And then you've got the, in SDK, go back to SDK. There's a folder that isn't versioned. Scroll all the way to the bottom. That one. And then open that and just get the size of that.
So then I would need to go into each of these.
Just get the size of it. Just get the whole size
of it. Well, it's going
to
be huge.
I understand. But just to give you a sense. How big is it?
Probably a couple gigs.
This is an immutable NuGet cache.
But the issue is that I'd have to go and find like
yeah.
the specific one here. And it's like,
right.
could be small, could be big.
Okay. But you can see the whole total there is 2.5 gig. Right?
Are these going to go away?
So let me talk about, yeah. So let me just, I'll continue on from where I was. Okay. Keep that up. So those three things that you've shown there are basically what contribute to the size of your .NET Core installation before 3.0. All right, you've got mm-hmm. the SDKs themselves, you've got the shared runtimes, and then you've right. got the NuGet package cache that gets laid down in program files.
Yeah.
And they all version with every single thing that you bring in. Generally, something in there, at least one of those will version, if not all three. All right, so mm-hmm. it depends on the size of the servicing release. And because .NET Core is side by side by default in the 2x timeframe, every time you install one, it doesn't uninstall the previous thing. Okay. Now, if you're using the VS Preview channel, which I think you have been, judging by what you yeah. have installed, the VS Preview yeah. channel will often deliver you a preview version of the SDK, because the SDK, part of it is tied to Visual Studio, because MS Build is shared, mm-hmm. and Roslyn is shared, and NuGet is shared. And so if you're on the preview channel, it will install new previews of whatever the next servicing release is. For VS, as well as the next feature release, even if .NET Core itself hasn't revved, if it's still 2.2.1, the mm-hmm. SDK will change, and so you'll get that another copy of that 60 meg folder, and you may get another copy of something else. And so you've kind of in the worst of all worlds, right? You've got previews, you've got RTMs, you've got, and they're all side by side. And so anything changes.
I'm not everybody, but certainly other people are having this problem.
It's pretty
as well
common.
Because they do. Now, let me ask you this, though. I recently went into Docker and I said, Docker images prune.
Yep.
What if I just said, shit, I'm just going to delete all this stuff. What would happen? What would break?
If you just tried to delete it without uninstalling it?
If I capriciously deleted everything that said preview from the NuGet fallback folder, would NuGet go and restore it the next time I type?
Yeah, of course. The stuff that's in program files is only there to facilitate offline experiences for the templates that are in .NET.
Can I delete this 2 gig folder? And if I did, what would break and how would it find its way back?
So you have another location where NuGet packages get restored to that is mutable. This one is immutable. Nothing gets added here unless an installer lays it down. Okay.
Okay.
When you run NuGet restore, they don't go here. They go into your user profile into the .NuGet folder. And so if you were to delete all of this, your machine would still work happily. It's just that when you next run a restore, you might find that it has to download an awful lot of stuff from NuGet.org because it doesn't have it there in program files anymore. Okay?
Yeah.
So in local, is I think it is local. Local.nuget.
Local or local low?
It's not local low. It's not in the app data.
Oh, it's not? Oh, no, it's up higher. It's just in the user profile. In .NET?
It should be .NET. .NuGet, sorry. While you're looking for it, I'll look for it on my machine.
There it is.
Got it? Yep. So this is your default NuGet restore location, which everyone else calls a cache. So this is where it puts things that it downloads from your configured feeds.
Okay. And is this a copy of the stuff? Because I might
no.
Be sad
so if it's in your
program, thinking this sucks.
Yeah. So like if it's in program files, that is configured by default when you do a .NET restore to use that program files location as a fallback feed. Or I think it has another technical name. I can't remember what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it won't download them if it finds them there, and it won't copy them into your user profile. They just live in program mm-hmm. files. Okay.
But if I'm a hater and I'm watching this stand up mm-hmm. religiously because mm-hmm. I'm a hater and a lover, and I say, well, shoot, I've got a Docker Hello World application that I run at scale, and it's only like 50 megs.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a, like a nice Docker container. And I did tree trimming, and Hanselman's always on stage talking about how small the .NET framework is.
Mm-hmm.
At runtime.
Yep.
But here I am with 3 gigs and 7 gigs. Does this mean I can start tweeting Microsoft with a $ for the S and, you know, talking about how they suck?
Well, you wouldn't be comparing apples to apples, but I'm happy to explain the one big difference. One, yes. you talked about a runtime image. So obviously, once you've taken your application or your project through your compile chain to produce the artifact that you'll actually run in production, a whole bunch of stuff happens, right? And you don't mm-hmm. need to be able to build that artifact on the target machine that you're running on. Most of the stuff that you have inside that 2 gig file, 2 gig folder, isn't mm-hmm. DLLs. It's build targets and it's XML and IntelliSense files.
Ah, okay. So that's not a pile of DLLs trying to take over the world.
And they're not compressed. They're compressed when they're in NUPKeg form because that's a zip file. But on here, they have to be expanded because your IDE needs to be able to open the XML files to show you statement completion help. Okay, and it might deliver 14 different languages to do so for a bunch of those packages. So a lot of it is multiple. It's not duplicated. It's triplicated, even more, up to 14 times, one for each language. And there's a whole bunch of historical reasons about why the trade-offs that we make, whether we should always acquire things on demand from the internet, which then leads to problems with regards to I mean to do a thing, which I thought I had it installed, I got on a plane, and now I can't do that thing. Versus the disk space that it takes you, versus the install time, versus the size of the download you had to start with for install, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we've constantly, over the whole 10 years I've been here, playing with those trade-offs. And as the industry trends change and hard drives get cheaper and internet gets faster in some places, not others, we reevaluate those trade-offs. Mm-hmm. And so for 2x, I've kind of laid it out. This is everything that there is. You can safely delete everything, but if you want the leanest possible 2x install, what mm-hmm. you want to do is delete uninstall every SDK except the latest one.
Okay.
And then install just the runtimes that you need. So the latest SDK will come with the latest matching runtime, so 2.2.3 mm-hmm. or .4 or whatever it is. And then if you need to run 2.1 apps or you need to run 1.1 apps or 1.0 apps, you can just install those runtimes. Okay, you get the installers for those runtimes.
I'm here deleting previews because they've been lying around for a year.
Yep.
And, yes, it's annoying, but it's not, it's not killing me. I'll be done in 5 minutes here.
Yep.
But I've got all these SDKs.
Yeah.
You're saying I don't need really
you don't
any
need
of
any
this
of them.
Stuff.
You just need the latest. Like VS, you don't need to keep all the VSs, right? You just get
now,
the latest
I
one.
Do I even need 2.1? I would just need 2.2.203.
You just need the latest SDK. And if you want to really live on the edge, you could just use a 3.0 preview SDK unless you need to use VS 2017.
So you're saying if 3.0 does the job it's supposed to do.
Yep.
It is backwards compatible with all these things.
Yeah, just like VS is meant to be. Your tools are supposed to be backwards compatible. That is the intent. So the mistake, mm-hmm. obviously, then, with that statement that we made was that we didn't make the tools uninstall the previous version of themselves, right? Because if they're backwards compatible, why didn't we just make them uninstall the previous version?
So you know how Visual Studio has this lovely installer now that is smart about stuff, and I enjoy the Visual Studio installer. It works very nicely. Mm-hmm. And it is always keeping my Visual Studios healthy, and I don't feel like it clutters my...
Right.
My app,
app
like it used to.
App, add, remove programs, yes.
Add, remove programs.
Yeah.
But this is obviously cluttered.
Yes, it is. And so we are going to fix that.
You know, just the fact that there are scripts, myself and others have these scripts. You agree we shouldn't have to do that. So then for 3.0, I would expect if I installed the new one, it would go over the top of the old one.
Yeah, so 3.0, we have a different default behavior, which is the SDK installers will uninstall the previous version within the feature band.
That's already happening.
Yeah, so you've only got one 3.0 preview.
I've installed 3.0 for a bunch, and I've never thought about it. It's just been chilling by itself.
There you go. You got one.
There's my Visual Studio installer. I've got an internal preview of the next... whatever, 6.1.
You're not using the dog food. You're not using the dog fooding bill. Is that the
internal?
Well, it's a few different internal feeds. There's the public preview channel, obviously, and there's a number of internal channels. The one that we're told to use in DevDiv typically is the internal dog fooding channel.
Probably not for a couple of reasons. So first, I am on an internal network right now because I happen to be in the local office.
Okay.
But when you're on VPN, it's a little more challenging to stay fresh.
Yep.
But additionally, because I want to be, no disrespect, closer to the community than I am to you.
Yes.
I tend to run what the community runs.
Yep.
So that I'm seeing their reality and not internal reality.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. What I heard is you're not a team player. And that you're actually on team community.
And it's review time.
So Scott, if you're listening, that the handsome one just said he doesn't use the dog food bill. So yeah, and so in 3.0, the behavior has changed. Actually, that is the internal dog fooding build. So you're doing the right thing. Well done. I just publicly admonished you. Yeah, so the 3.0 behavior for the SDK installers is to remove the previous SDK install. So any preview that's in the same, see the version number 22100. The 100 is the SDK version. And so as long as the new version you're installing is in the same band as that, so it's 10 something, it'll just remove any previous 10 something. Okay. And for previews, so that's why you only have one version. Once we get, you know, to GA or whatever you want to call it, released in September, and then we start working on the next feature release of the SDK, which is likely going to be 3.0.200. If you were to install 3.0.200, it would not remove the 3.0.100 SDK because that's considered a new feature band of the SDK. There's still mixed feelings about opinions on whether that's the right thing to do by default, but that's what it currently does by default.
Yeah, and there's a lot of commentary on people probably in the comments right now, as well as comments on Twitter. And would you say that when you and others say, hey, it's hard, that they don't understand
it's
how hard it is?
It's incredibly difficult. It really is.
This is not a matter of saying, why don't you just?
No, it's not. And a lot of the times, it's very easy to come up with the idea of what it should do. Just make it do this. It would be so much better.
But you have to not break the world.
One is, it might be better for your scenarios and your workflows. Two, it may not be, you probably haven't considered all the ways it interacts with different versions of Visual Studio. Like if you have, you know, different channels of VS from different versions of VS, how does that interact with that? Does it work with VS Code, which has a very different way of finding .NET than VS does? And then we have to consider server installs and runtime installs separately from SDK because they have different implications. As I said, the SDK is meant to be backwards compatible. So it shouldn't ever break you, but there are compatibility issues with the SDK and versions of VS, which is why, for example, there's two download buttons on the download page right now because you need to get the right SDK for VS 2017 because there are shared components. Now,
then what does that do though?
What does what do?
This NuGet locals
that clears all the NuGet caches, but it does that are places that NuGet will restore to. NuGet does not restore to program files.
Right. Does it not think about things in terms of this?
Yes, it should clear those.
So that is 6 gigs.
Yep, your local NuGet. Yeah, which way? Because it's every version of every package you've ever restored.
So if I understand correctly then, every version of every packet I've ever restored, given that I might want to restore it again at any moment.
That's right.
So if I clear that
and
get on an airplane, I will be sad.
Yes, you will be sad. You won't be able to build anything.
Okay.
Yep.
And then what will happen is I'll be in the hotel Wi-Fi or on the airport Wi-Fi, and I'll be like going, you know, .NET restore for the last X number of projects, and it will eventually build up again to some size.
Now, except for what's in program files, because the SDK in 2x does bring a whole bunch of NuGet packages with it. It's actually the largest part of the payload. All because the build mechanism for projects in in 2x is NuGet packages. You have package references in your project for ASP.NET Core, and that's where it finds the reference assemblies. That's where it finds the XML IntelliSense files. That's where it finds the MS build targets. They're in NuGet packages. Now, in 3.0, that's not the case. In 3.0, we have changed what we call the composition model of .NET Core projects. So they're still SDK projects. That hasn't changed. But we now have a thing called a framework reference. And so people might remember in ASP.NET Core 2.1, we introduced the shared framework for ASP.NET Core, mm-hmm. as opposed mm-hmm. to using the other thing we had, the mm-hmm. store, the package store. So that's kind of gone now. So instead of using a package reference to represent a shared framework, now we have a new thing in MS Build called a framework reference. And that also is something that NuGet understands. And so you don't need NuGet packages to build an ASP.NET Core app unless you're referencing, you know, an external NuGet package. So if you do file new ASP.NET Core in 3.0, eventually, depending on which template you choose, you won't have a package reference. The SDK will behind the scenes just default you to the framework reference for ASP.NET Core.app. That's the name of the shared framework, just like it was in 2.1 and 2.2. And there is a folder under your SDK folder where you were looking before. If you look in the 3.0 hive, you'll find a place where ref packs are installed. And a reference pack, it's just like they used to be before we had NuGet, is basically a flat layout of stuff needed to build certain types of applications. And they aren't NuGet. The SDK will acquire them from NuGet on your behalf if it realizes you don't have them, but they're not NuGet. And the advantage of that is they don't carry runtime assets. They only carry build time assets, which means that we can be much more granular about what's installed on the machine, and we don't have to duplicate or triplicate or quadruplicate, whatever the word is, quadplicate, lots of copies of the same files across various NuGet package versions or ref packs or runtime packs, et cetera, and so what you'll find, the end result of that is there should be a lot less disk space taken up for a 3.0 application. It should build faster because there's less stuff in the build graph for the tools to reason about for ASP.NET Core things. Now, as soon as you need something external or something that's not in the shared framework, you'll add a package reference just like normal, and that's how you'll get stuff. But for stuff that's very core to the platform that ships in the shared framework, you don't use a NuGet package anymore. So that a lot of that work is what we've been working on in 3.0 to help improve this situation, which is, oh my lord, it takes a lot of disk space, it looks like, to create .NET Core. I have a lot of versions. We're trying to fix that. And then the other thing that we're trying to fix, that download page that you showed, is pretty good, like especially when you compare it to other download pages for other stacks. Like go and look at the Java download page and you'll hate yourself. It's a pretty good download page. It has good information, but it's still a lot of information, right?
So small fun story.
Yeah.
I know this lady.
No.
She is now almost... she's in her 40s and she has this was stock photography that she did.
Oh, really?
20 years ago.
That's fantastic.
And she has been the Java download lady the entire time. I think she was paid $50 and she's not happy about this.
Okay. So there you go.
This is look how small we are. We're amazing. Yeah. Right? Clearly I want to download this right now.
Right.
Lies.
Yeah. So and oh my lord, that's a lot of text. is the information I need in that text? I don't know. Let me go and make a cup of tea and then I'll read it.
Well, it's only update 212, so I think we shouldn't feel so bad about our versioning situation.
Right. So again, our download page as it is right now, we've worked hard on it. Unfortunately, the situation with the VS 2017 and 2019 kind of break that we had where the SDK had to split to support both did complicate our download page. We have a prototype we're working on right now, which we're not ready to show yet, but I hope that we will be able to ready to show soon, that basically builds what we're calling a universal installer. And so the .NET Core, and it's a little bit like the VS installer that you showed before, right? Which is known as Willow internally. So the .NET Core universal installer, the hope is that in the future, and it won't be part of 3.0, it'll be past 3.0, but it should be well before .NET 5, we hope, would be what you experience as a customer when you're installing .NET on Windows and on a Mac. Okay. On Linux, you use apt-get and you use the package managers on your thing. That's fine. But on Windows machines and Mac machines where you're installing SDKs and runtimes for servers for Windows, today you have to go to that download page and find the right link. You have to read it all. Go, okay, am I doing runtimes? Am I on IIS?
To be clear, you have to, I think the way you're phrasing is you have to think.
You do have to think. Annoying. But as a dev, you kind of just want to know, just give me some .NET. Just you know, man we used to work with, Kieran, used to say, just give me some .NET. Just go to the page and I just want some .NET. Just give me some .NET. Don't make me read a tome to do so. And so we're trying to get to a situation where you there's one download button. You know, the web page can figure out what OS you're on like it does now. It says, yeah, download.NET. You click that thing, you get a lightweight installer that then defaults and says, well, based on your machine, I think you want these things. You know, it can detect VS. It can detect that you're on a Windows client OS versus a server OS, and it can choose the right things. And then it also gives you the options to select other things. So, for example, if you just want to install the ASP.NET Core module for IIS, which you can't do today, you would be able to do that through this installer. It would also support multiple version channels so that you could say, well, yeah, I want the latest SDK because, as I just said, you should always have the latest SDK, but I need to run 2.1 apps because that's LTS. Well, it would offer you the 2.1 runtime. We don't have an experience like that today. You have to go and get the 2.1 runtime installer separately after you've installed the SDK. There's no CLI experience for SDKs or runtimes today. We have aspirations to have the CLI allow you to launch the universal installer. So not only can you do info like you did here, you could do .NET something update, and it would launch the installer in update mode and tell you if there are updates available for anything that you have installed. These are all things that we want to enable. None of them are free. None of them are cheap. And you know, we only have a certain number of people who work on this part of the technology. And they have a lot of, you know, we have to keep Visual Studio running with .NET and all that type of stuff as well. But we are getting to a point where it's actually getting really difficult for us to, just the cost of maintaining the installers and inserting them into all the versions of ES that we have to support is actually getting very expensive. And so we're going to have to do this work to not only make it a better experience for everyone, but to avoid the cost that we're paying right now. So we see that as the future. So my hope is that by the end of this year, the .NET download experience and keeping it up to date on my machine experience will be drastically improved because of the result of the 3.0 changes we're making and this upcoming universal installer. So, yeah.
Let me ask you this. What's going on here?
What are we looking at? Netcore app 3, bin release. Oh, yeah.
So, this is a daily prototype build. Like this is a direction that we want to go. This is, I thought I could be clever, and like right click on this and open it in a zip file thing, but it's not a zip file.
So
it's
you have turned on publish single file.
Yeah. So what I did was I went over here.
Yep.
Into this application here, which is a non-trivially sized app. It's not small. Mm-hmm. It's got a lot going on. Greenshot is a.
It's open a screenshotting project. App. Isn't it?
Yeah, screenshotting. Yep. It's a very sophisticated one.
Yep.
And I went in here and didn't change anything here.
You just passed it at the publish time.
Instead, made a publish profile.
Yeah, I was doing this last week. It's good fun.
Called Super Magic, Holy Crap, which changes the project file at the time of
publishing. Okay. Yep.
See what I'm saying? Yep. Like a publish. People think that these things need to be, like, you need to set all of these properties.
I just pass it in as a command line argument when I do the publish.
So,
but yeah.
So what I do is when I right click and say publish in Visual Studio.
Yep. You say generate
profile. I pick this one.
Yep.
And then it swaps out.
Right. So you've turned on two things. So I can talk through what's going on here. So there's a couple of properties. From line 12 down to line 15 is what's interesting. So first of all, I'll jump line 12 and I'll come back to it. So you've got self-contained equals true, which we all know means bundle the runtime with me.
And right? I did that right here. So if we go here and here, this is self-contained.
Yes.
374 items of DLLs. It's all of .NET Core plus screenshot exe.
That's right. So it's any dependent. It's all the frameworks that you used plus any dependencies it had from NuGet or loose assembly.
And I didn't do any tree trimming here. So there's like stuff that it doesn't even use, like system.net.mail.
Yeah, because we don't have that yet. I'll talk about that.
Right.
So in preview 5, we enabled of 3.0, we enabled a single file's been. Standalone has been enabled since the beginning of .NET Core. The new thing, if you go back to your project file that you had, your props file. Public XML file. So if you look at line 15, publish single file is the new thing that's available in preview 5. And this is the single XE launcher that we talked about for .NET Core 3, which will basically take everything that would have, all those 300-odd items that you said, because this is a self-contained app, and just sticks them in a self-extracting XE. Now, You can do framework-dependent single file as well. You don't have to do self-contained single file. You can do framework-dependent single file. The way it works is that executable, when it runs, will generate an ID based on an algorithm, and then it will look for a folder in a temp location with that name. If it doesn't exist, it will extract the contents of that exe into that folder, and then it will boot the application from that location. Okay. So this is work that's been done in the .NET host that is the executable. And so you end up with one executable, and yeah, it'll be one of those. Generally, the easiest way to do it is to run the app and then attach a debugger and then look where the modules are loaded from.
Yeah.
And then you can just see the DLLs are being loaded from a temp location. So, but as you said, it's huge, right? You did single file and you did self-contained, and it's everything. Now, you had to specify a runtime identifier right now. You have to tell it where you're generating this XE for, because XEs are platform specific. So you have to say win x64. That's what the RID or the runtime identifier is. Okay. So it's not portable. You can't take this single XE and run it on Linux. All right. You have to build it separately for each machine. Now, what's coming in preview 6 is the ability to also enable trimming or linking. Okay. Where using the mono linker, this is not it's and you can kind of think of it. Yeah, I wasn't probably not like that. It's the monolinker technology, and so it will attempt to statically analyze your application and then remove methods and whole modules that you aren't calling. And so I haven't actually tried it yet. I look forward to trying it in the preview 6 builds, because it hasn't landed yet. It's supposed to land this week. The other thing that is enabled that you're not using is publish ready to run, which was turned on in preview 5. Now, ready to run is the public name of CrossGen. CrossGen is the .NET Core version of NGen. So,
okay,
NGen,
so that's the thing that like pre-choose your food and gets you ready, so that it's one less thing for the end user to have to do.
Yeah,
when I double click on this, it'll run.
Yeah.
But today in this prototype slash whatever, it's reading files out of a compressed format. It's saving them to disk. It's picking them up again. So there's some dancing that doesn't need to be done. It's got files it doesn't necessarily need, and it's still got to go and JIT it once it's all done.
So it'll only JIT. So the stuff that came from the shared frameworks is already pre-jitted. It's already cross-genned, already ready to run.
That means everything in here, all these DLLs are pre-jitted already.
Which is why they're bigger. Like often the cross-gen versions of those DLLs, they contain both the IL and the AOT'd or native code that was created by the ready-to-run tool. And so that it can fall back if you try to run that DLL on a machine that is the wrong bitness or the wrong native target. It's an ARM machine instead of a x86 machine, for example. It'll just load the IL, right? And it'll JIT it on the fly for you. And so, but what you can do now is publish ready to run equals true will ready to run your application assemblies. Anything that didn't come from the shared framework or any NuGet packages that you had that brought in DLLs, they would get ready to run or cross-genned as well. And then on top of that, 3.0 enables tiered compilation by default, which is the new mode of the jitter that can recompile the machine code of even those cross-genned bits at runtime to further enhance them for the actual CPU that you're running on.
Hang on a second. You keep talking. My kid's school's calling.
Oh. Okay. So that capability is on by default in 3.0. That's the new tier compilation JIT. And that helps you. It does a couple of things. It will improve the startup time of the application because it can do a sort of lower quality JIT compilation of your IL up front to get you going quicker. And then it will look at what code is being executed in your app and then recompile that harder. It'll recompile that with better quality, which can take a bit longer but produce faster code. The other thing that it'll do is any part of your app that was cross-genned or ready to run, I use those two terms interchangeably, one of the problems with ready to run is because it can't do certain optimizations with assemblies that are marked as ready to run. For example, it can't inline methods across assembly boundaries. And so what happens is you can lose performance with a ready to run application. For example, when we submit our Tech and Power framework benchmarks, we actually turn off the ready to run loading in the host so that we get the jitter to compile everything at runtime, which means it can optimize things in the most beneficial way. In 3.0, you don't have to worry about a lot of that because it'll just do it for you by default. You can get the benefits of cross-gen for the startup speed because it's already pre-jitted, but then the tier compilation will kick in once the app is running and recompile the cross-gen stuff to make it fast again, and then make it even faster on top of that with the JIT stuff. So
here's a question then. If I do that, if I turn on tier compilation, if I go and use Mono's experimental linker that I was doing 2 years ago.
Yes.
And then I take that with additional technology that's not us.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called Warp.
Yeah, there's a few bundling techs out there, right? IL merging.
Is that okay? Like if I'm doing that.
It's for your definition of okay.
Well, let me rephrase. What is the difference between messing around with a linker from 2 years ago and messing around with someone's Warp Packer deal that's used for other things versus waiting until the fall? Like what will be better or worth waiting for our thing versus some of these technologies that bundle and zip up our stuff and simulate a single
EMC? I don't know enough about how the approach that the other technologies use, but I'll wax lyrical about a couple of things as best I can. So first of all, the bundling tech that we're putting in .NET Core 3 maintains the ability to do things like profiling and debugging without any convoluted mismatches, okay? Because it actually maintains assembly sort of assembly modularity and identity into your application. IL merge, for example, used to destroy that, right? You kind of it just merged IL fact, and then now that it's a different assembly.
So it mangled the resulting runtime thing so much that to
if you took a memory dump and then tried to
go all the way backwards and try to figure out what's going on, you control
a light just went off in here. That was ominous. And so that's one thing. Second of all, obviously this one is in the .NET Core product, so it's supported by Microsoft. That's obviously a big deal to a lot of customers. And so rather than using another piece of tech, you can use that one. That's just a question of support. With regards to the approach, the first one, as I said, the Mono linker has a bunch of different dials and knobs. I'm actually not aware of how much of that we're exposing yet, and that's one of the things I'm looking forward to playing with once it drops in the preview 6 builds. Also, how well they work for different application types is interesting. So obviously the Mono linker is primarily being tested to date with mobile applications, because that's where it's used in the Xamarin applications. This is the first time we've taken that technology and adapted it for Windows desktop applications and hopefully ASP.NET Core applications. But we're not quite sure yet how well it's going to work out of the box for ASP.NET Core applications because of the nature of how dynamic ASP.NET Core applications are with regards to discovering things at runtime, emitting code at runtime. Those approaches to building applications or frameworks can make it very difficult for linkers that rely on static analysis because they can't tell what you're going to do at runtime. And they may remove code out that it turns out you actually needed because the code that needed it doesn't exist yet because we don't generate it until runtime. Okay. And so we have to look at that as part of this stuff landing. So what's the difference? There's lots of differences.
But also I understand that is it not the intent that the basic, like the naive implementation of a single XE is unzip into a temp folder and run.
Yes.
And the idealized one would be a highly optimized, tree-trimmed, cross-genned executable with just the stuff that you need, no more, no less, that doesn't unzip into a temp folder, but rather unfolds into memory.
Yes. And
intact and debuggable.
And that is on the table currently for .NET 5.
Cool.
So our hope, so this is the first iteration of our single file story, where you can optionally then add cross-gen or ready to run, and you can optionally add the IL linker, the trimmer. Which will get you so far. And then the hope for .NET 5 is to bring Mono's full AOT tech, which was part of the announcement at Build, to .NET Core. And that's effectively what .NET 5 is, right? .NET 5 is .NET Core, the next version, plus the Mono AOT runtime, which is different to Core CLR. Core CLR is the CLR runtime with the jitter in .NET Core. Mono has its own runtime written from scratch, effectively, with its own jitter, which is only used in some environments. It has an IL interpreter, which we don't have in Core CLR. The IL interpreter is what's being used in Blazor when you run on WebAssembly. And then it also has a full AOT chain for compiling C# and IL into native code for environments where you cannot run a jitter. You're not allowed to, for whatever reason, whether it be on in the browser because it's not efficient to turn IL into machine code, into WASM in the browser, or you're running on an Apple device where they restrict you because you don't have memory access to marker pages, readable or writable and then executable as a security precaution or whatever it might be, right? And so the combination of those two technologies, we hope, is going to give customers a very flexible approach to saying, these, you know, it's always a set of trade-offs. This is computer science. This is software development, right? So it's always a set of trade-offs. We all want everything all the time, but sometimes you have to give people options so that they can choose the right deployment path based on where they're going and the trade-offs they want to make. The big thing is we want to make it so that it's available to all the .NET app types. So it doesn't matter if you're doing mobile apps or desktop apps or console apps or API services or Blazor applications in the browser or traditional ASP.NET Core apps. It doesn't matter. Or IoT apps or machine learning apps with .NET Core. You'll be able to use, have the same option for all of them, okay, with the same set of trade-offs. So if you want the smallest possible XE and you're willing to sacrifice a little bit of startup time or a little bit of runtime throughput, then you can choose one runtime. But if you want a separate set of trade-offs, then you can choose you can tweak the knobs the other way. So
right, I think it's cool that Greenshot is working on this, even though it's both modern code because it's being actively worked on.
Yeah,
and it has lots of plugins. It uses Reflection. Like, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah,
but also that it's been in development for 12 years.
Yeah. That's great, isn't it?
And it started up by, like, he is not running.
Yep.
1,002, 1,003, 1,004. So 4 seconds while I'm installing Visual Studio.
Mm-hmm.
Probably would have started faster if I wasn't installing Visual Studio right now.
Right. And you're just running that straight out of the publish folder?
Yeah, just running it out of here. And I put it on a USB key and I ran it on, like, my wife's machine who doesn't have .NET, and it just worked.
Oh, and it's self-contained as well. Okay, yep. So you're doing self-contained, single XE. Okay.
Right. And now, of course, you could even, I suppose, put that in the store. You know, theoretically, like, you'd want to be able to put all this stuff in the store. And
yeah, you wrap it in an MSIX.
Optimizations.
Yep, wrap it in an MSIX container, and then you can publish it to the store. And
yeah, things are getting better. I'm on a Surface Book Pro, Surface Book 2, rather. And even though we're sitting here complaining.
Yeah.
I'm still on a Teams call. I've just updated two different in the time we've been hanging out here, in an hour, I've uninstalled 12 different SDKs. I've updated two versions of Visual Studio, and I'm using Teams and it's still working, and I'm, you know, nothing's broken.
Yeah.
So, like, as much as I complain about computers, they are doing their jobs.
Yeah, we just want it to be better, you know. If I could trade,
I want it to move at the speed of thought.
Yes.
That's what I want.
I don't want lag. Lag is the thing that really irks me.
Yeah.
That's the thing that really... Yeah, so, like, in summary, we didn't talk much about .NET 5. Obviously, that was the other big announcement from Build, was talking about what .NET will look like moving forward. I briefly just said basically what .NET 5 is. We will have .NET 5 will release next November 2020. That's the other thing that we announced, was the...
Reliable
date-based... date-based releases. So every 2 years, you'll get an LTS of the new... .NET. So .NET Core 3.1 will be November this year. That will be the LTS for the 3 wave. And then .NET 5 will not be LTS. It will be .NET 6 that will be the LTS after that, which is 2 years after the previous LTS. So that's the new cadence. Every 2 years you get an LTS, and each one is supported for 3 years. So you get 3 years to, once you adopt an LTS, if you adopt it at the beginning, you get 3 years to think about and plan for moving to the next LTS. It's also very worth stating that we don't intend moving from LTS to LTS now to be like moving from .NET Framework to .NET Core, right? Like that is a fairly large move. We totally acknowledge that. We're going from, you know, 1 15-year framework that's Windows only, monolith, you know, it's installed on the machine, it generally isn't side by side, to a very different model for .NET, which has to run everywhere. And so folks who have been on the sort of .NET Core journey with us from .NET Core 1, .NET Core 1 to 2 was, it could be painful. If you were there in Project JSON, moving to CS Proj, we had a migration tool. It wasn't perfect. But once we RTM'd in 1.0 on CS Proj, moving to 1.1 was fairly straightforward. Moving to 2.0, we changed a bunch of composition. We went from NuGet packages to runtime store. We did a bunch of things. But most customers I've spoken to who were there on 1x and moved to 2x were able to do that so fairly successfully. It wasn't a massive, arduous task. It may have taken you a couple of days for a complicated application. And then obviously from 2.1 to 2.2 was pretty trivial. It's, you know, change some references, follow the migration guide. You really should be able to do each project in a matter of minutes. Moving from 2x to 3.0 for ASP.NET Core applications, fairly straightforward. Again, the project file just gets simpler than it was in 2.2. You'll remove some packages. You'll have to add some other packages back because we did remove some things from the shared framework, but that's all in the migration guide. And we haven't made a lot of big breaking changes. The breaking changes that we have made in APIs in 3.0 for ASP.NET Core. Generally in one file. They're in your startup file or in your program main. So you do them once per application, and then everything else in MVC and the middleware stuff is the same. And then there's new APIs that you might want to move to because they're idiomatic and they give you new advantages. Obviously, moving a desktop application from .NET Framework to .NET Core 3 is a much larger task. But we've seen people be successful with it already, as you know, you just demonstrated.
Well, and it's not impossible. Like, I know that there's a lot of people who are frustrated because if it is your application at your company and you've been working on it for 20 years and you feel like you're going to be left behind, then your perspective is 100% of people will not be able to move. But I was at a very, very large bank in Europe a couple of weeks ago, and they had like a million lines of code, like literally a million, million and a half lines of code, 1,000 projects. And they're slowly building a conversion tool. They're identifying namespaces that are compatible. They're running, creating a database of a portability analyzer results to figure out what plugins are going to be movable and what aren't.
Yep.
But at the same time, you can run a .NET Core 3 application and call Windows APIs, right?
Like, yeah.
Moving to .NET Core 3 is different from moving to .NET Core 3 and remaining portable.
Yes.
And I think people don't understand that. I think that's worth calling out, that .NET 5, .NET Core 3, whatever, if you're on Windows and you're moving a Windows application, it is a different task to state, I'm moving from the .NET Framework 4.8 to .NET 5 in some theoretical future.
Right.
And I'm taking my Windows app that uses WCF and Windows Transaction Managers and COM objects and and I'm going to make it run on Linux. That's a different, it's a very different task.
Yeah, and like as always, the task is going to be dictated by what dependencies you have more than the code that you wrote. Transfers over just fine. It's C#. It's what that code is calling. That is your dependencies where we see most of the folks having heartache. You can write tools that convert project files. You can write tools that do analysis and you know, remove code or add code or generate code. Like any team of any reasonable size I've worked in 20 years had some type of code generation tool, whether they bought it or they wrote it. Most people end up doing that type of thing. So that's, and I think most people accept that for this nature of a change, that's going to happen. The more painful things are the things that people have alluded to, like, you know, the no WCF server in .NET 5, .NET Core 3 or .NET 5 is obviously going to be painful for some folks who still have a requirement for the features of WCF server. We do have WCF client because obviously interoperating with WCF servers or servers that, you know, use some of those features are from new applications, including desktop applications, is important. And then also web forms. Now, I will say we have a lot more customers using ASP.NET MVC than we do web forms. MVC has been out, 10 years now? It's a full decade that ASP.NET MVC has been out. But of course, there are still people actively working on web forms applications. I don't know if they're making new applications as much as they are people, you know, maintaining existing applications. And as we've said, and we've talked to a lot of these customers, like let's be very clear, we do talk to customers a lot. And we see the full gamut from folks who have, you know, .aspx files with all the code in the code behind to very well factored, oh, I just need to move my UI. I mean, I say just, but obviously there's still a large amount of work. But a lot of those customers have been doing that stuff anyway. A lot of people went through the MS Ajax transition. A lot of folks started removing logic from their web forms apps and moving to more JavaScript-centric, you know, client interaction models over the past decades. And, you know, even more customers went to MVC and ported their ASP.NET applications to MVC in this past time. And they move to ASP.NET Core quite a lot easier than MVC applications. So there are a few different approaches folks can take. Stack Overflow is going through this at the moment. You know, Nick and the folks there are publicly sharing the details of how they're approaching it. And you know, and they're eyes wide open. They knew it was going to be a lot of work. I think they've said it's going to be about 18 months to 2 years to fully complete. And they have a very complicated set of applications. It's not just one app, right? It's dozens of applications that work together to form a system. And they're doing what you'd expect. They're moving the shared code as much as possible. They take all code that is shared out of the applications, put it into .NET standard class libraries to get the actual apps as thin as possible so that they only, you know, the bits that touch the pixels or the bits that touch the wire is what's left in those edge applications. And then they start the process of moving those applications to .NET Core now that the bulk of the code and the logic has been moved into libraries that can be shared. And they're still mostly in that phase of moving shared code, I believe, or they're coming up to the end of it. I think I talked to Nick a couple of weeks ago. And they're now looking at moving their Razer code, for example. So we added features based on their feedback in ASP.NET Core 3 Preview 5 to enable Razer, what do they call them? Razer functions in a CSHTML functions block. And they use that heavily throughout the UI for Stack Overflow. And we've talked to other customers who are taking different approaches. Some customers are, I'm going to leave my WebForms application as it is, but I'm going to use IIS virtual directories to create new areas of the application in ASP.NET Core and then share authentication tokens, right? I mean, I remember doing that with ASP Classic and ASP.NET when it first came out. And you'd have some parts of the app that were .ASP and some that were .ASPX.
Well, I'm doing that today. I've got DOS Blog, which is a 4.7 blog engine on web forms, but my front end for my Hanselman.com website is Razer Pages.
Right.
Yep. And they live together and work together in the same IIS.
And I've seen even more complicated, integrated applications where they're not even the same stacks. Like the same app from the customer's point of view using it in the browser looks like one app, but it's actually a Java JSP app plus an ASP app plus some other type of technology. And you share CSS and you use iframes. And that's how you make your migration over time.
I have to go.
Yes, we should.
Into the other room. I'm giving a presentation to a bunch of engineers here at Microsoft Portland. So I apologize. We're going to have to.
It's been an hour. I know
we're more than late.
Yeah.
Cool.
Lovely to talk to everyone. We will be back shortly. We need to get the three of us on again. So. Bye.
Bye, everyone.